Session number 9271, Reel 5.
Brigadier Vickers, Reel 5. You were just saying you were asked to pull back really rapidly.
Quick.
Yes.
And I was told, there's the train, get in, your two trucks there, and we got in two trucks. I tried to march my company back, and I was infuriated when somebody said to me, don't waste bloody time, get in the trucks. And I said, this is D Company, we get in properly. And, you know, a bit of panic by then. Anyway, we got on the train, sat there for a bit, a lot of shooting up front. Bear's people came back, and there were two buses to take the rear guard back, which was one of the companies, Kerbalai. And we all got in, and the train went doo-doo, and off we went. And I lit my pipe. I still had a little tobacco left. Lit my pipe, and it was just getting dark, and thinking, well, by God, it's about 30 miles, 40 miles. We'll probably make it in 2 hours. I shall be in... Oh, you know. And then everything stopped, because we probably know the story. They'd blown... The Luftwaffe had actually hit a bridge, and they didn't know about it, and the two engines capsized, and the leading coach where the people were slaughtered in it and things like that. And we had this train crash. We were all terribly shaken. And I had a chap who broke his back, for instance, in the thing. What can you do with a chap in the middle of the night, miles from anywhere? Terrible. And to cut a long and horrible story short, we were told to get walking down the road, and that there was a tunnel at a place called Verma, which was 3 miles away. And that there they would collect us another train and we, or transport, and we would be taken down to the Navy and evacuated. Well, the tunnel was, I've variously described as 15 or 18 miles. It took 6 hours to get there, and I'm ashamed to say that my company and the battalion and the force absolutely disintegrated. And I can understand why. They were dead beat, they were tired, frightfully tired. They'd been told to march for 3 miles. After they'd been marching for 4 hours, there was no sign of the tunnel. Fortunately, we were not interfered with from the air, much, a little bit. But men were discarding weapons and so on and so forth.
We're just throwing them away.
Yeah. It was terrible. I felt awful about it. I picked up a rifle of 50 rounds and carried it. And I walked with the brigade major for quite a long way. And I remember it after years, it struck me, it must be a pretty bad thing if a company commander in a tree walks with a brigade major. There's something wrong. And it really was, we were finished. There was no fight left in us, there and then. Nothing to fight with, no command structure, nothing. Sub-keeper down the road. And we eventually got to the tunnel, which was a ghastly place with an engine with steam up, and you could imagine the atmosphere. And some Royal Marines appeared to give us rearguard cover, and the remnants of the force, it was a force then, not a battalion or anything, streamed into the tunnel, and we tried to sort out in the tunnel, in the dark, in this terrible atmosphere, and it really was very difficult. But some sort of order was restored. And then I went to sleep. God knows how. I climbed on the top of a wagon or something, which I found was full of explosives. And I went to sleep, and then I woke up, and there I heard shoutings and things like that, and I scrambled off the truck, and there were green hires around me, and I said, where are the Kerbalai? They said, up there. So I went up there, met by an infuriated CO, saying, well, how bloody hell have you been looking everywhere for you? And I said, well, I'd been asleep. In my company, I was asleep. Well, you should have been out there protecting the front of the tunnel and so forth. And I said, well, I've been asleep. There it is. And police said, I was wrong. I had gone to sleep. But I don't really know then how I could have done anything else. There was nothing to do. I'd sorted out my company as much as I could. But it was in no sense was it a company that could fight. But there was a bit of action. The Royal Marine rear guard covered us, and then we got on another train And there are all sorts of stories about that. But the engine driver ran away. But the staff captain, what was the staff captain doing there? He had driven the train in the general strike, so he said, I'll have a go. And he got it going very well, but he didn't know how to stop it. Well, he didn't think he did. So when we got to Andelsnes, by the grace of God, the points were set into a siding, and we ran through the buffers into shingle, and that stopped the train. So we got out, and we then formed up into some sort of column, and we had a nightmare sort of shambling march through Andelsnes, which was burning to hell, and it was dark, down to the waterfront, and there was the Navy. And there was no question of greenhires on here. It was get on, whether you were the Major General or a private soldier. And I got on HMS Manchester. And I was just about to be taken down below by an enormous sailor in a singlet when the tannoy boy said, this is the captain. I want 6 infantry company commanders on the quarterdeck immediately. So here we go again. So I went, where's the quarterdeck? I said to the sailor. Follow me, sir. Splendid chap. Went down there, and there were 6 company commanders. And there was a motley collection of NCOs, one of mine I recognised, and some Marines. And he said, pointed to me, he said, you take this lot, and there were, I think, 4 Marines. He said, disembark down that gangway, turn left, and destroy every bit of equipment on the quay. I will give 2 hoots on the hooter 5 minutes before I go. 5 minutes after that, the gangplank gets up, and you're there. Quite clear? Do what damage you can. Yes, sir. I went down. I had 4 jolly Marines. I had a corporal from my company called Hyde, who'd been a assistant head waiter in the Queen's Hotel in Leeds, and 2 other men I don't know. And the Marines had a sledgehammer. He had 2 cans of petrol and things like that. And we found 6 vehicles which had just been loaded. And I said to Corporal Hyde, can you really immobilise those? And he said, with pleasure, sir. I know exactly what to do. And then we went on and we found some Bofors guns. Well, I knew about Bofors guns because I'd learned how to use them in Norway. So we took the breech blocks out, and if you really hammer the breech block to pieces and chuck it in the oggin, the Bofors are not going to work again. And some motorcycles, and then, woo, woo! Marines all said, that's it, sir. And we turned around and we went on board. And she sailed at pitch darkness, no radar, down the Gonsbeck Fjord at 32 knots with Glasgow, Curacao, which is an anti-aircraft cruiser, 1 Polish and 4 British destroyers, and that was the end of Andelsnes. And when I got back on board, not the same sailor, but the same sort of shape sailor, said, what are you? And I said, I'm an officer. He said, come with me. But before that, he said, got any grenades? And I said, yes. And he took them, he chucked them overboard. But I went down, and I was put into the wardroom, and he said, sit there, and I'll get you. And he came back with a mug of ship's cocoa. I hadn't had anything to eat for 36 hours, I would think. A mug of ship's cocoa, which you can sit on it. It's marvellous stuff. And I'll never forget this. And a great tin of Singapore pineapple, which he'd take with it, and a fork, and he said, that's all I can get you at the moment, sir. And I had this thing, and I ate a whole tin of pineapple. And that was the end of the South Norwegian campaign, except for one thing, which I will tell you, and if you... I will ask you to stop the tape in a minute, because I don't... we went back to Glasgow. We were bombed by the Luftwaffe. It was all very exciting. We got back to Glasgow. directly we got there, the captain came on and said, I've got to get you off, soldiers. I'm sorry, I've got to go to sea in an hour. So we were ferried over in drifters to the guard ship, the Ark Royal Oak, where my cousin was the officer of the watch, which was quite... I telephoned my wife from the guard ship, and that was a good thing. First contact. and Manchester and the things cleared in an hour and a half and put to sea. I mean, we churned them to the Echo. Marvellous. And then we went down to the southern end of Scarpa, where there was this huge liner, the Lancastria, and the force was put on there. And we sailed down the Minches in beautiful weather like this for 3 days. She'd just come back off West Indian cruising, and it was on the house. And the soldiers were having five-course breakfast and all the beer they could drink. And we landed at Glasgow. I suppose there were 1,000 of us left of the three battalions and the force headquarters and the odd bits and pieces. And we were all formed up in a... in a warehouse. And the CIDS, Field Marshal Ironside, appeared. Can you stop the tape? Please. I thought I'd better...
Having gone through the Norwegian campaign with the shortages of food, sleep and so on, how long do you think it took for you to recover from its effects and become fully battle-worthy again?
Personally? Oh, 24 hours in the Lancaster, good night's sleep, good wash, clean clothes, clean my boots and things like that. I was ready to go again.
Was there any formal or informal debriefing of you after you got back?
There was a certain amount of post-mortem went on within the battalion about various disappointments we'd had and things that hadn't worked. But I don't remember anybody from outside talking to us or coming to... No. You see, by the time we got off Lancaster, it was the 8th of May, we went to Galashiels. And then it was the 10th of May, which everybody was looking towards Flanders, so we were no further interest to anybody.
Did you find that the civil population knew anything at all about what had gone on in Norway?
My impression was that they did. And my impression was that they thought that we'd done a good job there. But this is a rather selective lowland country town, Galashiels. But the troops were rather tended to be given pints of beer in the pub, which is not usual in Scotland. Yes, I think they did know what was going on. And, of course, then Belgium had started and the army was... Interesting reflection on Norway. Now, in the whole of Norway, I saw General Paget once. And as he was a light infantryman, I knew him and he knew me, and we exchanged words. And he said, "Tell me what it's like." And I said, "Well, sir, we're absolutely impotent. There's nothing we can do. I can't kill the Germans." And he said, "Yeah, yeah, that's all." But, I mean, he knew it better than I did. I never saw anybody but other infantry people. I didn't see any sappers, I didn't see any gunners, I didn't see anybody. I saw the major in the ROC. I think he must have got lost. But I didn't see anybody else but infantry. You see, there was no force. It was just three infantry battalions, one of which took a bloody awful knock the first time it was in action and really didn't perform again. And then ourselves and the Green Hearts fought the rest of the campaign, and I became very friendly with the Green Hearts, had a great respect for them. But there was no question of a force. It was just a...
How long do you think it took the battalion to recover from the losses, in effect?
Well, not long, because we had a very great CO, Edward Ernest Eden Cass, DSO MC. You got a bar to his DSO... richly deserved in Norway. He, when we moved from Galashiels, we had a short leave, and then we were recalled after 4 days, I think. I won't bother you with detachments in that Erda flat, but for instance, I was sent down to Purbright to form a special company to go to France and do something, but I didn't go. But by about the 1st of June, the battalion was complete again, had received considerable reinforcements, and had moved to a place called Stobbs Camp at Hoyock, where we were re-equipping to a full scale, because we found out the 15th Brigade was the only fighting formation fit to fight in the whole of Scotland. And we were made up to a brigade group, and they produced a field artillery regiment. And I got an FOO living in my company. This was a big step forward. And we got mortars, and we got anti-tank guns, and we got buses, and we were made up to a brigade group, and we started to train very hard, day and night. And the CO was at us all the time, and he said, there's one order and one order only, that wherever any man goes, by day or by night, he will carry his weapon. And if I see anybody who's not doing it, he'll get 28 days detention. This included the boy's anti-tank rifle. And if you went to the cinema, which we were allowed to go to once a week, you carried your boy's anti-tank rifle with you. And wherever you went, whatever you did, you had your hand on your weapon. And he couldn't do it with the anti-tank guns or with the mortars, but wherever the mortar platoon went, their mortars went with them. And he said, I'm doing this, that you're wedded to your weapons, and it's a soldier's first duty to hold on to your weapons. And we started to shoot, quite regardless of the countryside and so on and so forth, field firing. We started to use the mortars and the anti-tank guns, and we had a backbone of a good regular battalion. We got new equipment, and I reckon in about 1 week, I can remember taking my company group in buses with a troop of 25-pounders and a troop of sappers and a platoon of medium machine guns down from Perth, that's right, from Perth to simulate a counterattack at Lucas, which was on the coastal airfields, and it went well. And the chaps did what they were told, and people knew what to do, and we had a team. And I reckon we were fit for war by then, and fitter for war than we had been when we went to Norway. Physically, morale-wise, there was that, is it the Dunkirk spirit? I don't know what it was, but there was a change in attitude. And I think we were deeply ashamed of how we'd been thrashed in Norway. And old Coppercast said, I don't want you to waste bullets on the bloody Germans. I don't want to waste your dirtier bandits. I want to see you trample the buggers to death when they land. And we had a very offensive spirit and were prepared to use our weapons and ourselves. I would have said a month. But a remarkable CO for that purpose. Marvellous man.
You say you had a lot of reinforcements. Were these also former regular soldiers coming back as reservists, or did you have to absorb conscripts?
A great mixture. We got our MT party back from France somehow, which was marvellous to see, about 70 or 80 of the old hands back with the vehicles. How the hell? I don't know. That's one of those miracles. There were conscripts. There were people who'd been sick and on courses and some of that, and I think the A staff had worked pretty well. There were new faces. There were new officers. We got rid of... We had a shedding of officers. By God. You can't pick up a chap who's retired, age 47, and tell him to go and command a rifle company. Can't do it. And the personnel staff thought you could in 1940, but it was no fault of theirs. And they had a very useful role to serve somewhere else, but not in an infantry battalion.
Did you also have a sorting out of NCOs?
Yes. Yes, it was quite serious. I think I was very lucky in my company. I can remember one sergeant whom we had to get rid of, and there was deliberation whether he should be court-martialed. I certainly had 5 or 6 people knocking on the door for a promotion who'd proven themselves good soldiers. I'd had one senior NCO who was physically not up to it, but had a lot to offer, and he went back into training job and did a wonderful job in the war. No, there was not a great program of hangings and shootings and so on and so forth. There were quite a lot. There were 1 or 2 awards, and there were a lot of people waiting for promotion.
Did you find that the new arrivals sank into the battalion and became part of it quickly, or did it take some time for them to be absorbed amongst your veterans, as it were?
And I think the veterans just picked them up quickly. I think a Yorkshireman does this and absorbs them and teaches them. I would think that's true, yes.
What do you think the most important lessons that you learned from Norway?
Well, if you're going to go and indulge in a war, you've got to be trained for it. And it is no use being heroic and going off to fighting the 16th Panzer Grenadier Division with bows and arrows. You've got to have the equipment to do it. But provided you've got adequate equipment, and provided you're properly trained, and that you've got a good command structure, and through your training your morale is high because you believe in your own fitness and prowess, and you have pride in your unit, then I reckon you're ready for war. But it's a question of pride in the unit, mutual respect between all ranks. I mean, the majors are respected by the subalterns, and the subalterns are respected by the sergeants, and vice versa all the way down, provided you're trained in the use of your equipment and you believe in it. You're about ready for war. We certainly were in 1944. Absolutely. Rather like this chap Bruno two nights ago, we were stripped the last ounce, and I felt rather sorry for the German army in Normandy at times. I know we were a bit ponderous and slow, but I was a very disappointed officer when I came back from Norway. I reckon that I personally had been not given a fair chance. I reckon my company had been given a fair chance. And that the whole campaign, although I realised politically it had to happen, it really couldn't have been mounted in a more inefficient manner. And it was just sacrificing three regular battalions after you had sacrificed two territorial battalions. And we were absolutely caught short by the Germans. They were prepared, they had a plan, they had a command structure, they had the equipment and the training to do it. And we paid the penalty that the regular forces always pay, pulling the plums out of the fire for the politicians who weren't to spend a penny on a bayonet. Pacifists. And it's happening again today. This very moment it's happening.